So what would you do if I offered you a Bitcoin? It's money, though it's not invented by a government or a bank, but by a few individuals. It has no regulation. It's not rooted in the value of some precious metal like gold. But as of yesterday morning, that Bitcoin I offered you would be worth $126. I'm Brian Ellison. On today's Central Standard, we take a look at Bitcoins, a currency that exists only in digital form. People are using them to buy cars, appliances, services, trading them for hard cash. We'll explore how a small group of people created value out of nothing but an idea and what the future may be for virtual currency. We want to hear from you. Do you use alternative currencies like Bitcoin to finance your daily life? Join our conversation on Central Standard after the news. So you get to the coffee shop and you hand over your phone, which they scan to take money off the coffee shop card, but there's not enough left on it, so they swipe your credit card to reload it, and at the end of the month, the credit card bill comes by email, so you send an electronic check, paid for out of your bank account where your paycheck was direct deposited, you never even thought about it. We live in a digital economy, there's no doubt about it, but is the day coming when the numbers in all those transactions won't even be dollars, but rather bitcoins? Or something else? This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we talk about a new form of currency, one that exists only as lines of computer code, but with which you can buy website hosting or jeans or alpaca socks. Is it the next big thing? Or is it a huge headache for regulators and potential victims of fraud? Bitcoin and other digital or virtual currencies are what we're talking about today. And joining us to help us get our head around this is George Selgin. He's a professor of economics at the University of Georgia. He's joining us from WUGA in Athens, Georgia. Welcome to you, Professor Selgin.
Thanks, Brian. It's fun to be here.
In just a bit, we'll be joined by a local business person who's made some hard cash by mining bitcoins and helping others to do it. But first, George, let's start with an even more basic question, not about digital money, but just about money. What gives the paper and metal that we sometimes used to carry in our pockets value?
Well, in the case of modern money, the value comes solely from the convenience it offers in purchasing things. It sounds like a circular argument, but money is valuable because people will accept it for other things, and it's easy to purchase things with. Old-fashioned monies, commodity monies like gold and silver, they had a value to start with, and so it's not so difficult to see how they could gain extra value by being convenient for making general purchases. But paper money that's not attached to a metal or anything else is a little trickier to understand. Mostly, paper money's got off the ground by first being convertible, and then one day the government stopped converting them into gold or silver, and they kept on being valued purely as media of exchange. So that's how we got paper monies.
And so
Bitcoin is even harder to understand, but we can tackle that one later on.
Well, indeed. And I have to say I'm among the first to admit I can't get my head around it. But but sticking with the paper money, the dollars or the euros that that people are familiar with, who is ensuring that the value is retained in that kind of money?
Well, with those monies, indeed, there is an insurance challenge. Basically, their scarcity is an artificial scarcity. So the insurance consists of the commitment of the authorities to not create too many units of the stuff. There is no absolute guarantee that they will honor that commitment, and that's why we occasionally have hyperinflations. But we rely on central bankers to maintain the scarcity of this stuff because, of course, if they want to, they could make oodles of it until each unit isn't worth any more than the paper and ink, if that. And, of course, when that happens, the currency becomes absolutely worthless.
Of course, that has happened at various points in history in various countries.
Indeed. It's always a risk. And even in our economy, there's no physical barrier to the Federal Reserve engaging in a similar hyperinflation. but we hope that the Fed will not do so. And, of course, we don't have the kind of fiscal situation that has made our government desperate enough to want to encourage such a thing.
Not yet anyway, right?
Not yet.
So let's switch over then to a virtual or a digital currency, and maybe even you could explain what those terms mean. How is something like Bitcoin different?
Well, there are really two kinds of digital currencies, Brian. And as you mentioned in introducing the program, a lot of the currency we use that's dollar-based today is digital. But those currencies really are like IOUs to the dollars that the Federal Reserve creates. And in that sense, they're not so hard to understand. They're really just versions of what we've had all along with bank balances and that sort of thing.
And does that mean that the digital money in my checking account, let's say, which I have never seen as actual stack of cash, albeit a small stack, that physical cash does exist somewhere in someone's bank vault, right?
Well, not quite.
Okay.
The banks will have, of course, some reserves of actual cash, either as physical cash or as credit balances that they hold at the Federal Reserve System. But most of your digital dollars are backed not by such reserves, but by other bank assets, because although you have a right to get that many dollars back as your account balance shows, in the meantime, the dollars that you have a right to are the bank's property, and it lends most of them to earn the interest that it covers its expenses with and often shares with its depositors.
Okay, so then how is this other virtual currency different?
Well, Bitcoin, which is one of the only other kinds that really has taken off, doesn't consist of IOUs to any other form of currency. It is a basic currency itself. So in that sense, it's more like actual Federal Reserve dollars, except it's not issued by any government. It's a private basic currency is more like gold or silver coins were, in that it is something that is actually scarce, not in a conditional way, not because some government authorities are managing it to keep it so, but because a clever computer program only allows so many of these units to be Bitcoin units to be created.
So who wrote the computer program?
Well, nobody knows who wrote the program. There is a Japanese fellow or someone with a Japanese name who is supposed to be the genius behind it all, but it's a pseudonym, and it may, for all we know, stand for a committee or something. But in any case, the actual origins of this idea are somewhat shrouded in mystery. Perhaps our other guest can reveal some of the details. I certainly am not privy to them. But the interesting thing is that once the program is up and running, which of course it has been now for some time, no one is capable of altering it. Another way of putting that is to say that nobody can counterfeit bitcoins, because every bitcoin that is mined by means of tapping into this program and solving a problem connected to it has to have a provenance every time it is used that traces it back to its original creation. And in this way, it's practically impossible to spend a fake Bitcoin or even to conceive of one. And that gets into the computer technology and software that is behind Bitcoin, which again, I'll leave it to someone who knows more to talk about those details.
And we will definitely get to that. I guess you've compared it to the more traditional understanding of money that is backed in that case by a central bank or by a government that exercises some control over the money supply and gives it some protection, some guarantee. Is there anything equivalent that is protecting or guaranteeing the feasibility of a Bitcoin if I have one in my wallet that makes it secure, my digital
wallet?
Well,
in some ways, Bitcoin is more secure than government money. It really resembles, in some ways, more a commodity money like gold. than government money, because as we've seen, Brian, in the case of government money, we hope that the authorities will keep this stuff scarce, but we know that they don't have to, and sometimes they don't. And then, of course, the currency becomes worthless. With gold, of course, the secret is there's only so much of it in the ground, and even less that's actually exploitable, and so its scarcity is absolute. We never had to worry about a gold standard hyperinflation. It was just out of the question. What we did have to worry about was the fact that there could be chance discoveries or shocks to the demand for gold for non-monetary purposes like filling teeth. Those things could cause the value of gold to fluctuate in undesirable ways. And so that's the usual complaint about a natural commodity as money. Bitcoin has the scarcity of gold in that the program design will only allow 21 million or not even that many bitcoins to ever be mined. But because the scarcity is written into a computer program, it is a sort of synthetic commodity, and there are no shocks, there are no discoveries that can upset things. Yet there's no authority that can just change his mind and make more of them at will.
So who is accepting bitcoins as digital currency these days?
Well, nowadays, a lot of people are. I read that the recent number of registered merchants accepting bitcoins for all kinds of things is up to 10,000, and that number may not seem very large, but what's impressive is it was only 1,000 about a year ago. So the network is taking off, and it's the nature of a currency network that the bigger it gets, the more likely it's going to get bigger still. It gains momentum as more and more people join it.
And that also gives more value to the bitcoins themselves.
Other things equal, it will tend to raise their value. That's correct, especially in light of the fact that the supply of bitcoins, as we've seen, is cannot go up beyond 21 million, and it's approaching that limit already. So the likelihood is that bitcoins will continue to have value unless some regulatory interference causes their usefulness as exchange media to be undermined, or unless someone comes up with a superior alternative that people switch to, which could always happen.
You know, I was looking over the list of some of those who are accepting bitcoins. There are a few, I guess you'd say, mainstream companies. WordPress, which hosts websites and blogs. OkCupid, the dating site, is accepting bitcoins. Uh-huh. But mostly we're looking at smaller merchants. Some interesting things. Alpaca socks, as I mentioned, pet supplies, designer jeans. But I guess I'm wondering, what would motivate a person to use bitcoins instead of dollars? Most of those sites, you know, they'll still take your credit card.
Well, indeed. I think that originally the motivation was largely ideological. Something like that has to explain the very first people who accepted these things in exchange for valuable stuff, because they couldn't count on someone else being around who would also trade for them. And that ideological angle, an angle that refers to the fact that a lot of people just like the idea of a currency that's totally independent of government, and they're expressing themselves by patronizing such a currency. That's still part of the story, and I think it's part of the mechanism that's causing certain merchants to join the network ahead of others. But again, as the number becomes larger, it'll be more tempting for more merchants to just go ahead and offer this alternative for the sake of any customers whose business they might not get if they didn't. But the big sea change may come if we see eBay or PayPal join in, which there has been some talk about, though neither of those companies has taken the step. That doesn't still mean that that bitcoins will be as popular as dollars for exchanges on those networks, but it could keep the momentum behind them going.
Could open the door. We're talking today about Bitcoin and about virtual currency. My guest that you've been hearing is George Selgin. He's an economics professor at the University of Georgia, also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. I want to bring into the conversation Josh Zerlin. He's the chief operating officer of Butterfly Labs, which is in Leawood, Kansas. Among other things, they sell equipment for Bitcoin mining. Josh, welcome to the program. Josh, while we talk with Josh, I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation as well. Have you ever used Bitcoin or some other digital currency? What did you buy with it? Why not just spend dollars? Tell us about your experience. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And, of course, given this digital topic today, we are on Twitter. You can tweet at us there, at KCURCST. Josh, help us get our head around how this whole thing works. Professor Selgin mentioned mining bitcoins. What does that mean? How is a bitcoin generated?
Well, bitcoin generated through...
I'm sorry. Go ahead. There you go. Go ahead.
Okay. Bitcoin is generated through a mathematical algorithm where you take the... what's called the blockchain, and it has basically a number, starts with the seed number, and you take that number, apply a mathematical calculation to it, and you come out with another number. And if that number is below a certain amount, it's considered a valid block on the network, and that's what generates a block of 25 bitcoins, currently 25 bitcoins. And the difficulty of generating that number is what causes the artificial scarcity that Professor Selgin mentioned. And as more people mine bitcoins, the harder it gets to mine bitcoins. So only a certain number of bitcoins are released in a given period of time.
Okay, so a computer is just trying all of these algorithms until it finds the one that unlocks this
right.
Bitcoin.
Right. It's purely random chance. And the more random numbers you can generate, the more likely you are to generate a Bitcoin.
So you need special computers for this?
Well, you don't need special computers. You can use your desktop computer for it. Unfortunately, the days of using your computer for that, just your CPU in your computer for that, are pretty much over due to the size of the Bitcoin network. The Bitcoin network is currently the largest distributed computing project in the world right now. And because of that, it would take a very, very long time to use your computer to generate a Bitcoin.
Now, I understand that when you started doing this yourself, you did this in your basement, right?
I did. I did do it in my basement. I started with actually a laptop computer back in 2009.
But that doesn't work anymore.
No, definitely not. It would take years and years and years just to generate even a fraction of a Bitcoin with a laptop nowadays.
So it doesn't really take skill, but it takes the right equipment.
It does take the right equipment. We've moved into what's called the ASIC era in Bitcoin mining, and that is specialized hardware that performs these computations very quickly.
So I guess help us get our heads around this. Who decided that the solution to this problem this algorithm would be the way that something would have value? In other words, no one's in charge of this, but someone had to get the ball rolling and decide this is how we're going to make something that has value.
Right. That was either a person or a group of people by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto, which, as I'm told, is kind of the equivalent of John Smith in Japanese.
Okay.
So it's like a professor.
So it's not a real name.
Right. It's most likely a pseudonym. And that person or those entities decided to do this to basically prevent lots of Bitcoins being put into the network at an unmanageable rate, which would drop the value and people would lose confidence in the currency and it would become worthless.
But is there still some central computer that is holding the codes that divvies them out at the right moments so that the...
No. It's called a P2P network, peer-to-peer, similar to BitTorrent and those type of networks where all of the code, all of the data is stored on all of the computers that are participating in the network.
Now, okay, so you do, let's say you uncover one of these bitcoins as your computer does the work and it cranks one out. Now what happens? You have a bitcoin.
Now you have a bitcoin, and there's a number of things you can do with it. The primary thing a lot of people do is they go to an exchange, such as Coinbase or Bitstamp, and they exchange it for their local fiat currency, like U.S. dollars or euros or British pounds, Japanese yen, and then they spend that money however they want to pay for the electricity that they use to generate it or what have you, or a pack of socks. Or you can spend it at, as again, Professor Selgin said, there's over 10,000 merchants currently accepting Bitcoin.
But if you find it, you get to spend it.
You get to spend it, yes.
So why isn't everybody buying these computers and mining for Bitcoins?
A lot of people are. And as more people buy it, though, it becomes more difficult for your particular device to generate a Bitcoin. So it's difficult to keep up with the process of mining unless you're really committed to it.
Professor Selgin, how then does Bitcoin become a more universal currency? I mean, can you compare it to the world of what I'm thinking of as real money or fiat money, as you called it? How does Bitcoin become on that level of universal acceptance?
Well, it's possible that it could become that popular. But of course, it might not. It's got a long way to go. But it could happen simply because more and more people find it a convenient alternative, whether because of anonymity, which of course is another factor, or because of ideological preferences, or because in some cases it can avoid some red tape or danger of fraud associated with other digital means of payment. So there are a number of factors that could give something like Bitcoin the edge. But, of course, there's no guarantee that those will prevail to the point where it really does rival anything like the dollar. It's very hard to predict since we've never seen anything quite like this before. But, again, the biggest thing with a currency, the biggest attractor is the size of the network, and it is this phenomenon where the bigger the network gets, the more attractive it becomes, that makes it possible that something that has gotten as far as Bitcoin has gotten can keep on going on the strength of this momentum. I don't think it'll ever drive dollars out as long as they are responsibly managed, but it could become a significant parallel currency to dollars.
So we've been hearing about sort of these exchanges. Josh, you were talking about you take your Bitcoin, you go to one of these exchanges, you can buy and sell them there. You know, I was looking at some of them. There's several of them available online. They range in value just this morning from 126 U.S. dollars to 140 U.S. dollars.
Correct.
Even, you know, today I could go in and buy a bunch at a low price and sell them at a high price. There's been a lot of volatility in the market too, right?
There is a lot of volatility, and there are a lot of speculators that do exactly that. And there's
day trading, essentially.
Day trading, yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of opportunity there. But because of the volatility and the unpredictability of the market, it makes it very difficult to do that. It's not as stable as like the New York Stock Exchange or what have you. So trying to predict what direction the market's going to go is very difficult. It's, mm-hmm. I won't say it's random, but it's more random than a lot of traders are used to.
How volatile has it been, Professor Selgin? What has been the range of value in U.S. dollars that a Bitcoin has
had? Oh, goodness. Josh could probably tell you more better than I can, but there was a major sell-off. What was that, about a little less than a year ago, if I'm not mistaken, that brought the value down to something like $30, $40. And then there'd been a spike before that. But it had been as high as 200, if I'm not mistaken, maybe a little bit more.
About
the range.
It was actually up to 260 and then dropped to 60 and then rebounded to about 130.
Now, if that were to happen with a paper currency, with a government regulated currency, that would be
a
dramatic moment for that country, right?
It would be. It would be absolutely terrifying for the people.
Indeed. If I could interject on this, Brian and Josh, on the one hand, you have extreme volatility, and part of this is just the growing pains. Once the medium of exchange demand for bitcoins becomes large enough, it can swamp the speculative demand and so stabilize its value. But the other thing that's driving the growth of the network is the fact that at least with Bitcoin, there's some prospect of a long run tendency towards appreciation, whereas with the U.S. dollar, we are pretty certain that the long run tendency is going to be the other way.
Josh, Professor Selgin mentioned that you can't counterfeit a Bitcoin because of this coding that traces every Bitcoin all the way back to its origin. Can you steal Bitcoins? Are there problems with theft?
You can steal Bitcoins.
How do you do it?
Well,
no, don't give us a how-to, but how do you do it?
You need what's called the private key for Bitcoin, and that's fundamentally what a Bitcoin is the private key. And if you're at all familiar with encryption, you have what's called a public key and a private key. The public key is what's used to send a message or a Bitcoin to somebody. You take their private key and it's or their public key, and that it's public because it's out in public. Anyone can access it.
That's how you find them.
That's how you find them. And you send it to that public key. And the only person that can decrypt or gain that Bitcoin is the one holding the private key. So if you obtain someone's private keys, you've effectively obtained their Bitcoins. It's the same as if you obtain someone's wallet, you've probably obtained at least a good portion of their U.S. dollars or whatever currency they're holding in it.
I see. So have there been problems? I mean, have there been documented cases of people stealing?
Oh, absolutely.
Bitcoins?
You know, one of the problems that a lot of people cite with Bitcoins is, you know, my computer's not secure. I have Trojans and viruses, and that can be a definite problem. So you need to take safeguards like you do with your money, put it in a safe, that sort of thing. And you do the same thing with a Bitcoin. You put your Bitcoins in a secure place. You put a password on your wallet, that sort of thing.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation about Bitcoin. We'll examine its environmental impact and what it's doing to the economy, if anything, and its possible future as government regulators have started to take an interest. We want you to join the conversation, too. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also tweet at KCURCST. You can also reach us by email at centralstandard@kcur.org. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about Bitcoin and about virtual currency, the way it may or may not be changing money and the financial system of our country and our world. We're talking with George Selgin, a professor of economics at the University of Georgia, as well as with Josh Zerlin, who is COO of Butterfly Labs, which is here in Leawood, Kansas. We also are talking with you, 816-235-2888. If you've ever used Bitcoin or you have questions about it, we'd love to have you join the conversation. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. We have a call all the way from Napa, California. Adam is calling. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Must be listening online, unless our signal has gotten a lot stronger. We're glad you're listening. What's your question?
I actually don't have a question. I feel like there's a better way to kind of explain why Bitcoin is something that's hard to predict what's going to happen, but that ultimately is going to have a really positive effect. So, you know, 30 years ago, you could look at the U.S. Postal Service, and they covered basically 100% of written correspondence. But now they have less than 1% of domestic volume in the United States. That didn't happen because email had a great marketing team behind it. It happened because email is literally better in every way that matters. It's faster, it's cheaper, it's more private, at least we used to think so. It's less vulnerable to tampering or damage. And Bitcoin is to money what email is to mail. It's faster in that when somebody sends me a Bitcoin, I can see the transactions within seconds or minutes, and I can spend it usually within an hour. It's cheaper. The fee to send the average transaction, from my math, has been about 5 cents U.S. dollars. And it's more private because people say that Bitcoin is anonymous, but that's not actually true. It's just that you don't have to use your Social Security associated identification with it. you choose what information you want to associate with your identity. And so it's actually much safer to do transactions online, because if a merchant that you bought something with gets hacked, then you're not vulnerable and your information isn't out there. And it's also less vulnerable to tampering, because Bitcoin is based on what you call a consensus-based reality. Whatever most of the network believes to be true is in fact true for all of the network. So in practical terms, that means that the network can break the rules of Bitcoin's monetary policy. Rather, that means that nobody can break the rules of Bitcoin's monetary policy unless more than 50% of the power in the network also wants to break those rules. And if so many people want to break the rules, then that probably shouldn't be the rule at all.
Okay,
so,
good.
What we're going to see is go ahead.
Yeah, no, I appreciate those points, Adam. I want to give George Selgin of the University of Georgia a chance to respond. Adam's making the case that it's not just an ideological interest, that actually Bitcoin is just plain better than using dollars.
Well, it's better in some ways. It is convenient compared to using cash. It's not necessarily that much more convenient than digital versions of the dollar, which can be very quick, for example. What I think Adam does point to, one of the advantages that's worth emphasizing, is you have something of the anonymity of cash, not entirely anonymous. But with cash, of course, you don't have the convenience and the speed. You can't do it online. You can't do it instantly. So here you have that advantage of normal digital monies combined with some of the advantages of cash, and that is a unique characteristic of Bitcoin. But I think it's a mistake to neglect that there are, at least for the current situation, there are disadvantages. There's uncertainty about regulation. There's volatility in the market, which we talked about, and most people don't want to be holding a currency that could, over the space of a day, lose a lot of value. So Bitcoin, precisely because it's new, faces some challenges that shouldn't be downplayed. Email, I don't think, had any similar, dangers associated with it. It was unlikely to be suppressed. It didn't face a volatility problem in the sense that you didn't know how good your email would be the next day, that sort of thing. So,
right.
We mustn't exaggerate the advantages, but we should recognize them, and it's possible that this could become increasingly popular.
Sure. Appreciate that. Josh?
Well, Adam did touch on an important point that I think needs to be reiterated. It is much safer to pay via Bitcoin because you aren't exposing your personal information, whereas you do that with your credit cards or what have you, either on the phone or over the internet. And this prevents the fraud. It prevents a whole host of problems that we have with the current digital money situation over the internet.
Mm-hmm. Do you still mine Bitcoins, Josh?
I don't, not really.
Yeah.
I used to, but it's with my position, it's more of a conflict of interest at this point.
Do you use Bitcoins in your daily life?
I do. I use them quite a bit.
Then you feel confident? You're not worried about the value being lost? Or
No, not at all. I foresee it going up quite a bit in the future. So I'm not one of the people that just wants to hoard it and hold it. It needs to be spent.
Well, you're a lot of people in that category. 816. Go ahead, George.
Sorry, Brian. We haven't talked about one of the problems with Bitcoin that is a problem if it does become much more widely accepted. And that is that it is a good news, bad news issue, in that because there's only 21 million at the limit, we won't never have to worry about hyperinflation. But on the other hand, if it takes off and becomes widely used, we do have to worry about long-run deflation should bitcoins become our standard monetary unit. And no one could ever change that. So to the extent that it may one day be desirable to have more bitcoins than the limit that's been built into the algorithm, we are out of luck, and something else will have to be resorted to instead.
May have to trade your bitcoins in for some other virtual currency.
Well, they'll be great to hold as an investment, but they won't make for the most stable monetary system.
Josh?
The one thing that overcomes that, at least to a degree, is the divisibility of the Bitcoin. with a dollar, you know, you can divide it down to one penny, which is basically two decimal places. With a Bitcoin, you can currently go to eight decimal places, and with a trivial code change, that can be changed to 16 decimal places. That makes, you know, even if Bitcoin were to go to $1 million per Bitcoin, you could still gain a large number of usable portions of a Bitcoin, even to, like I said, to a crazy amount.
And I understand that the one millionth or billionth of a Bitcoin is actually called a Satoshi, the name of the pseudonym of the inventor.
Correct, yes.
Let's talk to Matt in Baldwin City, Kansas. Matt, thanks for joining us on Central Standard.
Hi, good morning. Very interesting discussion. I'm trying to understand if I've got the analogy right here. It's almost like we live in an information economy, so therefore the currency is made of information. I'm trying to put that idea out. I'm kind of asking, is that a good analogy?
Interesting question. I mean, go ahead.
But can I refine the question a little bit more? This places the currency almost like having the qualities of a magic spell, whereas the magic spell is indeed an algorithm, which is a concrete mathematical type of reality, but on a kind of an archetypal level, it's almost like the Philosopher's Stone turning something of less value into something of, you know, ultimate value, which, you know, gold, you know, being the aim of the philosopher.
Okay, Matt, mm-hmm. I think this is interesting. I mean, you're touching on philosophy, not to mention children's literature. but I wonder, Professor Selgin, is that part of the appeal of Bitcoin as well, that there's sort of getting to something elemental, something basic, even if you can't see it and touch it?
Well, I think it is. At least, to me, there is something to this, we might call it the abracadabra theory of Bitcoin. It does remind one of the of alchemy and all that. What's interesting is you are synthesizing a commodity. It isn't. You're not making an actual commodity that has existed in the past. So we still haven't figured out how to make gold from base metals, but we've figured out how to come up with an artificial commodity with properties different from any of the others that. That can have value if it's accepted in exchange. And what I find fascinating about this is that if we can do it as we have, if it can be done as it has been with Bitcoin, in principle, we can make fancier synthetic commodity monies that have all the nice properties you would want from a perfectly managed fiat money. So, for example, imagine we could ask Ben Bernanke, and let's suppose we agree with his answer. Well, how do you think we should manage the supply of dollars so that we never have crises, cycles, inflation, deflation? And he gives us an ideal fiat money that fits that description. We could design, someone could design, a synthetic commodity like Bitcoin, but that has those supply properties. And that's a fascinating possibility to contemplate because it would make central banks redundant or OTIOs by giving us a commodity money that is perfect, not like gold where you might discover more of it or have a change in fashion that affects the value, but just it's a commodity, the supply of which behaves just the right way to keep the economy stable.
I want to ask Josh Zerlin, our guest here. You're the CEO of a local company that makes equipment that actually mines for bitcoins. How many companies are there like yours that are actually sort of making money based on the economy around bitcoins, not just from having bitcoins?
Well, there's currently three or four active companies that are shipping products, and there's another three or four on the horizon that are working on products.
It's a pretty small number.
Right. And we are pretty much the only one in the U.S. The rest of them are either in China or Europe. There's one in Russia. So we're the only U.S. provider of homegrown Bitcoin mining equipment.
I think it's fair to mention that that Butterfly Labs has taken a bit of a beating in the press for late deliveries on some of these supercomputers. There have been allegations that refunds aren't being provided to customers who didn't receive their products in a timely way. What's happening with that? Is this an expression of just the sort of the sudden upturn in this world?
Yes, and I apologize to all our customers for being late. We have, in fact, we're about 6 months late on our hardware because of some design issues and manufacturing and supply chain. We've designed our product from scratch. We designed the actual chip. We had it manufactured. We designed the board around it, the case. We've designed everything. So it was a very long and involved process. And throughout that, we had some hiccups. So we did end up being, like I said, about 6 months late. And that's caused a lot of controversy because the mining hardware is a time-sensitive device. And we're very apologetic for it. I wish we're doing everything we can to get that backlog of orders cleared as soon as we can.
People have been, they've tied up their money, but they aren't able to get any Bitcoins. So that's the concern.
Right. Correct.
I will understate it and say that some people are a bit hostile about this online. And I guess I'm wondering if that hostility in your view reflects sort of the volatile nature of the whole Bitcoin market and world at this point. Is this an example of what's different about Bitcoins than a more traditional money?
Well, I don't know that it's an example of what's different. I think it's more an example of what's the same. If you are in the business of dealing with another person's money, or their love life or something similar, they get very passionate about it. And that's what we see. You know, we're dealing with that. One of the problems I think with Bitcoin in this particular instance is that people are viewing mining as a magic money machine. Mm-hmm. And if they don't receive their magic money machine and it doesn't do what they think it's going to do because they don't understand the whole nature of Bitcoin mining, they get very upset and they lash out at the people. And I'm not trying to say that Butterfly Labs doesn't shoulder some of the blame here, because we absolutely do for being late. But at the end of the day, we're a hardware manufacturer of...
Just like if you made picks and shovels for mining gold.
Indeed.
Like you would be, you could be yelled at, you could be blamed, but ultimately you don't own the gold.
Right, and we don't control the supply of gold, and we don't control the Bitcoin difficulty, we don't control the exchange rate. We just manufacture the hardware.
Yeah. Paul in Kansas City, Missouri. Paul, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. What you mentioned about the picks and shovels for the miners, I thought I heard that the Gold Rush suppliers made more money than the gold miners at the time.
Yeah.
And I was kind of wondering in that regard, I happened to do a Google search in Bitcoin and Butterfly Labs pops up with a miner, roughly $5,000. What's the payback period in something like that projected?
Well, that's the question everybody asks, and that's the hardest one to answer because that is dependent upon the exchange rate. You know, if the exchange rate is $60 to a Bitcoin or if it's $200 to a Bitcoin, your payback period is dramatically different. Then you also have to factor in how many people are mining on the network at the time. If there's a lot, then your generation of Bitcoins will be slower. If there's only a few, then your generation of Bitcoins will be quicker. So that's almost an impossible question to answer.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions. Would you ever do this? Are you inclined to go mining for Bitcoins, or would you more likely go mining for gold? 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking with George Selgin, who is professor of economics at the University of Georgia, and also with Josh Zerlin, who's COO of Butterfly Labs in Leawood, Kansas, which makes machinery that mines Bitcoins. I guess I'm curious, Josh, how much does it cost to mine a Bitcoin? Obviously, it's somewhat unpredictable, but on average, if people are buying equipment, buying a supercomputer to do the work, they're paying for electricity to run the computer. Have you figured it out? What's the cost of getting a Bitcoin?
Well, it depends on how much you pay for electricity fundamentally. So, and we offer our next generation product, as the last caller mentioned, is roughly $5,000. We offer current generation products spanning the range from $250 all the way up to $22,000. So to mine a single Bitcoin, it's difficult to say. It depends on how much you've spent on the device. But if you are just looking at the electricity cost, which is, like I said, the fundamental cost you have to bear in mining a Bitcoin. It costs under a dollar at average U.S. rates. So
for an hour?
An hour, average U.S. rates is around 15 cents a kilowatt hour.
Okay.
So if you're running 1,000 watts for 1 hour, it costs you 15 cents.
Okay.
And
how often are you going to get a Bitcoin?
Well, it depends on the speed of your device. If you have, say, our $22,000 device, you get about half a Bitcoin per day of running that. And that costs you about $3 or $4 a day to run. So 2 days, you're looking about $12, $15 to generate one Bitcoin, which is currently worth about $140.
After you add in the cost of the equipment.
Right.
I guess my question to you, George Selgin, is why isn't everyone doing this? Is it just that they're not sure it's really it's going to last, or is there something more going on?
I think there's a little bit more going on. Economic theory tells us that for a mining proposition, we should expect in equilibrium that the miners like every other kind of business earn a normal return, nothing more. Certainly, as the person who called in mentioned, in California, the gold rush had people trying to mine beyond the point of even generating normal returns. So, it's an entrepreneurial venture, and in the beginning there are prospects for making supernormal profits, but it's no easy way to make a killing.
Sergio writes us in an email, Bitcoin sound like an elitist pursuit. Is there anything for people without supercomputers to use the currency? Clearly, mining the currency with a $22,000 computer is one thing, but anybody can go and buy a Bitcoin, right?
Right. And mining is a very small part of Bitcoin. Yes. And there's a lot of focus given on it because it is this magic money machine, print your own money kind of thing. So it garners the lion's share of attention when the majority of the Bitcoin activity has nothing to do with mining. Mm-hmm. That needs more focus, I think.
Right.
And it's a virtue of Bitcoin is that you can't make a killing by producing them. It does take a lot of effort because we don't want a money that can be easily reproduced. If we wanted that, why we'd stick to fiat money? And of course, if everyone could produce that, we'd have hyperinflation. So
Go ahead, Professor. I'm sorry,
Brian. The thing that makes Bitcoin money more attractive from an economic point of view is the fact that it's not easy to multiply the quantity of the stuff. We're glad we need people to mine it, but we don't want it to be too easy.
And to that extent, I do want to ask you before we run out of time today about the government involvement with Bitcoin. Much of our conversation has been about how it's different because it's not controlled with government monetary policy. But the fact is that the United States government and maybe some others have taken an interest in Bitcoin recently. What are the steps being considered to sort of introduce some regulation of the Bitcoin world?
As far as I know, Brian, the main rub here has to do with Bitcoin exchanges. These are the firms that engage in exchanges of Bitcoin for other kinds of money, including U.S. dollars. And those are the kinds of operations that have gotten a lot of scrutiny. The government really doesn't have much to do with mining, as far as I know, and Josh can correct me on this. Nor does it has it been inclined to investigate or give trouble to small merchants that are accepting bitcoins, unless the merchants are selling things that are themselves. Problematic.
Well, and there is some of that, right? I mean, isn't that part of the reason that the government's interested, that there is a concern about a black market developing?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's right. But the government can't suppress Bitcoin in the sense of making them go away. But where they can make life difficult for Bitcoin users is in suppressing these Bitcoin exchanges, which so far they're only trying to do by making them conform to all the red tape requirements that are involved in dealing with U.S. dollars.
So the government may not be able to stop me from selling illegal drugs for bitcoins, but it may be able to stop me from cashing in the bitcoins.
Exactly. That's the place it can most easily interfere because it already has an apparatus for regulating any dealings with U.S. dollars. Which are, by the way, and it should always be emphasized, Federal Reserve notes are the still by far most popular form of money for engaging in black market transactions. If the government really wanted to wipe out people engaging in those transactions or make those transactions difficult, the first thing it ought to do is suppress its own money.
Do users of Bitcoin want to see some government regulation to protect against some of this volatility, or do they want the government to stay out, Josh?
Well, you have the idealists who want the government to stay out, of course, but I know on the case of many of the businesses we deal with and talk to that are involved in the Bitcoin, we invite the government in. We want the regulation. We want to do everything by the book. We try to be as open as we can and do everything we possibly can to do what the government wants, because we don't want them coming in and saying, oh, you're doing illegal activity, you're doing this, you're doing that. We want it to be as upstanding as we can possibly make it.
Let's take one more quick call from Gene in Kansas City, Missouri. Gene, welcome to the program.
Hi. Boy, long discussion. You seem to be taking as a given that commodity-based currency money system is desirable as long as the commodity is stable, as Bitcoin is. And yet my understanding of modern economics is that most economists gone out of favor with a commodity-based, gold-based, hard money currency because it has no cushion and it has caused numerous crashes and permutations in economies.
Professor Selgin, 10 seconds. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, the rap that the gold standard gets for instability is much exaggerated. But the point here is that you're creating a customized commodity that is potentially free of the kinds of shocks and disturbances that could cause trouble under a gold standard. So in principle, it could be much better.
We'll have to leave it there. But this has been a very interesting conversation. George Selgin, economics professor at the University of Georgia, and Josh Zerlin, COO of Butterfly Labs here in Leewood. Thanks for joining us today, both of you.
Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome. Thanks.
You can subscribe to our podcast. You can hear this conversation again. You can access any of our previous shows at the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Join us tomorrow. We'll explore how an aging population is going to require some fundamental changes in infrastructure and housing. Also, stay tuned for Up to Date. Singing stars Karen Allison and Joyce DiDonato will join us. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.